Welcome to the 2Byte Conversations podcast, brought to you by Holland & Knight's Data Strategy, Security, and Privacy Group. We take a look at the ways data is being used to create a better world and how to manage the risks involved. From AI to innovation, robots to regulation, we look at data and its uses from all angles.
Today, we're going to discuss privacy management and operationalizing privacy programs. I'm thrilled to be joined by Aaron Mendelson. Aaron is currently a privacy officer at the LEGO Group, where he oversees data protection compliance within the digital technologies teams, including LEGO.com, LEGO Insiders, and LEGO Retail. Before that, he was director and chief data privacy officer at Ingram Micro. And from 2018 to 2022, he was adjunct faculty at Cleveland Marshall College of Law, where he taught privacy law and management. And Aaron, you only stopped that because you moved to Denmark. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah. Sadly, I had to give that up.
Yeah. Pretty fun gig. But picking up on teaching, I suppose, he recently authored the book Operationalizing Data Protection and Privacy, which provides readers with a framework for developing and managing privacy programs from foundational principles to operational components. The bricks, if you will, to use a LEGO analogy, used to build your privacy program. So thank you so much, Aaron, for joining the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Kevin.
So yeah, I wanted to kick off. I have my own copy of this book, and I've read it and really enjoyed it. You do a great job of laying out, you know, I use the analogy to the bricks, all the different things you need to do to build a privacy program. And I know you did teach in the past. What inspired you to put this book together?
It really started, actually, you talked a little bit about my teaching at Cleveland State University. And it really started with that course. I was brought in as an adjunct professor in 2017, right at the beginning of the GDPR era, and Cleveland State University School of Law was looking at developing a specialized certification program within the JD program to provide students with a background in cybersecurity and privacy law. When I went to law school, almost 15 years before that, there wasn't any concentration in this area. I was a night student and I was looking at how can I incorporate privacy law and cyber law into areas like workman's comp or Judaic law or some area where I always try to pull this thread of privacy and cyber into what I was doing. But fast forward to 2017 and they really thought, all right, this is an area that we can build competency in and provide our students a foundation. So they developed a core set of courses around what do students need to learn around cybersecurity and privacy to have that concentration. And I was asked to teach this course about privacy law and management, which wasn't intended to be a course on the fundamentals of data protection and privacy law. We weren't getting into the text of GDPR. We weren't going to read large treatises or the legal regulations. We really wanted to teach the students, what does it mean to be a privacy professional? What do you need to know if you were to work in a healthcare organization, a financial institution, another large type of company? What are those foundational elements to help you hit the ground running? And that I could teach the students to sort of have a leg up on their peers to be privacy professionals out of university or out of law school. And so we built that course and it was built with a lot of the elements that went into the book, one class or two classes on areas like we did get into sort of the foundational law of like GDPR in the European perspective and the US perspective. But then we talked about things like incident response. We talked about what do you do with a contract? What do you do with crisis management? How do you deal with relationship management? And really trying to teach those little elements. I called it sort of an inch deep, mile long view on data protection and privacy professions. And as you said, I taught that course for about 5 years and I had to say goodbye to being a professor when I moved over to the LEGO Group and moved to Denmark. And I missed teaching. I enjoyed sharing my knowledge with college students, with law students in that teaching environment. And I started a LinkedIn newsletter at the beginning of 24, kind of pulling in my old syllabus. It had been a couple of years since I taught, so I rearranged that syllabus. And I shared a LinkedIn newsletter with my LinkedIn network, basically a topic a week that I just wrote about and developed that newsletter over the course of 6 months in 2024. I was really fortunate and pleased to see that it found an audience and a large distribution beyond what I intended. And I got really positive feedback on that newsletter. People enjoyed the way that I was sharing that information in short bullets. I got some feedback too, like, hey, maybe you should make this into a book. And as I was nearing the end of that experiment, I said, all right, maybe I really do have enough to make this into a book. And I took a moment to kind of reflect after I ended that series and said, all right, how could this look as a book? And I didn't know how to transform it myself, but I was fortunate. My wife actually has a first cousin that is a business writer and business book editor, and reached out to him. And I said, hey, his name's Dustin Klein, and he has a side business. He works for some business journals, but does the editing and ghostwriting on the side, and said, you know, I think you have enough here. Let me help you transform it. And so really, for about a year, we worked on it together. We collaborated pretty much every weekend. We would have assignments. We took the content that was there already, transformed it into its own chapters, organized the material by sections, and then we started writing new material together, basically going back and forth and information that we thought would be valuable to add to that initial body of knowledge that we shared and that I wrote in the newsletter. I wasn't quite sure what it would look like at the end, but at the end, I think it came together quite well. I've been surprised to see it find an audience. I've been pleased to see people like yourself that have found it valuable. I think it could be basically read from cover to cover if you're new to the profession and trying to understand what does it mean to be a privacy professional in 2025. And I think it could be valuable in that way, just for more seasoned professionals to just have to refer to. And yeah, and so here it is.
That's great. You were talking about teaching the foundations of data protection and operationalizing the program. And one of the keys that you highlight there is relationship management and the importance of that. I think both with product teams, but then also with senior management and even people outside the organization. So just focusing on the organization first, as a lawyer, one issue you always face is there's always some sort of internal resistance when the lawyers are coming in, because people think you're always going to be just saying no, 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 no. How do you overcome that type of internal resistance within the organization?
Yeah, I do think it goes to a lot about being a valued and trusted partner with your internal stakeholders or internal clients. When I join any organization, or when I come into a meeting having not known the people in the room, I think it's important to build some sort of relationship or find some commonality that you can have, whether it's through sports or it could be something else. And I think you have to build that trust. And I never want to be the person that says no. Obviously, I think as a legal counsel or as a privacy officer, you have to be willing to put your foot down if it comes to that, or escalate to those that have the power to really put the kibosh on a high risk issue. But generally, you want to find a path to how can we do this? What are your goals? And I think if you can meet the business where they are and understand what is it that they're trying to achieve, if it's a marketing campaign and they want to market to a select group, is that group agreed to be profiled? Is that group agreed to receive marketing messages based upon that profiling? And if not, how can we do that? Or how can we get to somewhere close to that without maybe infringing on individuals' rights when it comes to that? So I think you have to be able to communicate very strongly that value that you bring, and that you're not just saying no, that you're trying to say, how can we get to your business objectives and meet those goals while still managing risk, minimizing any type of regulatory risk, and showing compliance on our part within the organization.
Yeah, I had Bethany Singer-Bajewski on a previous podcast. She gave this great analogy to, if you're bowling, you know, if you're bowling down, you'll hit the gutter an awful lot. If you put bumpers up, though, you can actually ball around all the way and
you
know, have more fun potentially and knock over more pins. And those bumpers can actually be freeing in a lot of ways. So yeah, three things you mentioned in the book: empathy, patience, and the ability to listen. I wonder if you could just speak to that a little bit more about, you know, really listening.
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, data protection and privacy, we're not driving revenue through the organization. We're there to help support your business in being compliant, managing risk, exhibiting trust, demonstrating compliance. Unless you understand the business, like I was just saying a minute ago, or you've heard the business as to what is it that they're trying to achieve, you can't come in and be like, this is what we're going to do, and I got the plan, and you're just going to outline this. You want to know, what is the business trying to achieve? What are their goals? And then you need to build upon that to achieve a compliant position. So I think you have to be able to hear what the business is trying to achieve, and you have to be able to be agile and react to what they have as their requirements. And if it's to drive a large campaign throughout the United States that meets a certain segment, like we were just using as an example before, then how can we do that? If it's to have a new product that captures certain amounts of data for a specific use case, you have to be able to hear, why is that use case important to them? And is that able to happen? And can you do that? So our role shouldn't be as a dictator or the privacy police necessarily. Although, as I said, you know, sometimes you do have to come in and say no to things. You want to use that as infrequently as possible to really, again, be a trusted partner with the business. And I think you have to hear them and you have to understand where they're coming from.
And hopefully you can say no, but here's what we can do.
And I think in those rare circumstances where you do have to be like, guys, this is off the table, this is entirely inappropriate, I think they'll value you and respect you a lot more in that situation when that's the last card that you play at the table.
So there's much more to the foundations of data protection than we just got into there. But the next part of your book is about the program development. And one piece of that that I found very interesting was about basically all that you need to do to get buy-in from senior management and demonstrating the value of an effective privacy compliance program. What are some ways that you do that?
I think the best way to do that is to show how do you embed into the organization and in the operations. And that's why I wrote the book to begin with, is that I think a lot of privacy professionals, and there's others that write on this, I'm not unique to this, try to articulate that you have to be able to demonstrate your level of compliance. You don't want to just say, we're going to do X, Y, and Z, and that's it. I think you want to be able to show how you get to a compliant position. Sometimes I call it a defensible position. Like, we're never going to be perfect. I think no organization can say they're 100% compliant 100% of the time to 100% of all the requirements. So what do you do to demonstrate that to the organization? And I think you show, all right, well, here are the different elements we have in our program. You can kind of use it like a Swiss cheese model too. Like, if you layer enough pieces of Swiss cheese on top of each other, you don't have any holes left in the cheese, right? And if you can do that with your data protection and privacy program, you can show your leadership, all right, well, we have strong training. We have some policies. We have embedded operations into our development process. And we have a complaint line. And we can deal with DSARs and all this. I think you have to be able to be a strong narrator to the teams to show how you're putting that all together. But then you have to be able to also show them what you're doing. And some metrics are helpful, like, you know, maybe how you respond to DSARs, how many you get, how you're embedding into the operations around maybe impact assessments or risk assessments, how you deal with third parties. But I think you have to be able to show we're trying to deliver some value to and make them quicker, more agile. We give them the decisions earlier in their development process by embedding earlier into the development process so that we can design and go to market faster and quicker.
You mentioned one metric being just the number of DSAR requests you're getting and the responses. Are there things like that that you can use that help to show the value of privacy itself? Like, people really care about this.
I mean, it's hard to measure like near misses, right? Or anything like that. And that doesn't necessarily materialize in a scorecard. I think what you can also show, though, is as your organization matures, the more things that you get reported to you as maybe minor incidents, the errant emails or the spreadsheet that had bad access rights or things like that. 10 years ago, no organization, probably very few, had visibility to what those were within their organization. But I think maturing organizations start to see those surface to them, you know, if they maintain some sort of breach notification line. So I don't always look at the number of incidents reported as a bad thing. I think mega or major incidents obviously are, but most of those don't require any type of reporting. They're just levels of non-compliance or bad access rights that can show that an organization is maturing in terms of its employees understanding the risks. I think the proactive outreach by product teams also shows that level of maturity. You can count how many risk assessments you do, and that doesn't necessarily always demonstrate compliance. But when you have proactive, the questions originate with the product owners or the business, shows that you're seen as the value to them and they want to engage earlier in their process as well. It's hard to always show to leadership, but I think you can explain it as, look, you know, this month we had 4 proactive inquiries into our privacy office, or 3 came from this product and 2 came from this, or, you know, 1 or whatever it may be. Or maybe your legal counsels that you also support as second line, sometimes they're more likely to get engaged because you're helping them return the answers to their teams quicker as well. And that helps everybody.
So I want to get into some of the operational components that make up a privacy program. Obviously, we don't have time in this podcast to get into all of it. And I do encourage folks to take a look at your book to learn more. Just to pick one out, PIAs. Can you explain what a PIA is and how you use them?
Yeah. So at its core, you need to do some sort of risk assessment around when you collect and process personal data. And I think the goal is to engage in some sort of development cycle early in it to do some basic risk assessment. That's how I view a PIA as
privacy impact assessment.
Yeah. But in my view, it's just, you know, an acronym we use for some sort of risk assessment so that we can understand what is it that team or that product development organization is doing when it comes to personal data. It could be as simple as just embedding into their requirements stage or when they go to secure funding, does it impact the processing of personal data in any way and have a broad definition and just have it be a yes, no. If you don't have the resources, at least start to ask that question. And then if they answer no, okay, they can move on. And if they answer yes, maybe you move them into a separate workflow where they engage with your team at a very basic level so that you can do some sort of understanding of what is that risk. Is it going to impact children? Is it going to impact any protected class? Is it going to collect any personal data that's sensitive in nature, whether that's health information or financial account information, ethnicity, religion, anything that's, you know, defined sensitive under GDPR? So that you can say, okay, if it is going to impact that way, then what do we need to add on to their development process? What do we want to see? Maybe it's a couple checks along the way to ensure that they're only collecting what's necessary. And we want to understand that there's a legitimate business purpose. But if there isn't, how can you push back and say, all right, maybe you need to think through this in a different way? I've been in organizations most of my career where individuals want to do the right thing, and I'm fortunate for that. But I can imagine in more startup organizations or early stage companies or ones that want to just go fast and break things, sometimes that doesn't always happen. And so I think you need to engage as early as possible and start to understand what that risk can look like so that you can provide the support back to them. I think one of the benefits too is if there is no risk or there is a very low risk, that you don't need to put the same level of scrutiny on everything. So you can start to categorize, and if you just keep it low, medium, and high, for lack of trying to get super fancy, low risk is maybe internally facing and only keeps certain low risk data elements like name and email address for authentication purposes, and that's it. You know, let that move on without a whole lot of scrutiny. But if it, as I said, children's personal data or sensitive personal data, then that maybe gets escalated into high and you have to go through a higher touch assessment or support workflow. And the harder part is everything in between. How do you group everything in that medium? But I think, you know, organizationally, you have to develop that sort of framework for what you'd categorize as high, medium, and low, and sort of create your own calibration as to where you want things to fall out.
And if you have that process in place, your teams can move forward with more confidence that you are acting within those guardrails. So children's privacy. Here in the United States, there are a number of newer laws that are expanding the scope of data protection requirements applicable to children, often expanding them to include minors. So the LEGO Group, and I'm not asking you to speak to your particular privacy program, but you have experience dealing with children, obviously. It's a product that is directed to children in many cases. Do you have any recommendations for people who are really new to children's privacy and data protections issues about how to deal with that unique set of data subjects?
The first thing I always tell people is look at the principle of data minimization. If you don't need children's data, don't collect it. So you can offer a lot of products and services to children without needing their personal data. So really question yourself, what do we need and why do we need it? Do we need it for a specific purpose? What is that purpose? Can we achieve it in some other way with anonymized data or de-identified data, whatever it may be, pseudo-anonymized data? That's the first thing I would say. Do not collect children's data unless you absolutely need it. And when you need it, and there are circumstances, you have to look at things like VPC or verifiable parental consent processes and make sure that you get the right level of consent from the parent. And it's sometimes a bit of a catch-22 because you need some actual data then from the parent and you generally need something that proves their identity. But once you do that, you can always get rid of that data. You don't need to store it long-term. But I think you have to look at, you know, what do you need and why do you need it? And if you actually need children's data and you need to know who they are, then you have to look at those mechanisms around VPC. I think explaining privacy concepts to children is extremely difficult. There are examples out there on how to do that, but I don't claim necessarily to be the subject matter expert in children's development and how you communicate. Yeah. But I think it's important where children's personal data is necessary to not just speak to the parent, but also to communicate in a way that the child understands what it means. There are good actors out there and there are bad actors out there. And I think you have to look at yourself and your own organization and say, we value children just as we do adults and we don't want to misuse their data. And if we don't need that data, don't collect it.
What is next for the privacy profession? I hear some people telling me that we're all going to become AI lawyers or just data lawyers generally.
Yeah, I do think there is a convergence of all these digital risks that would require us to become what I call digital compliance experts. I do think the privacy profession is evolving. I think we've reached a level of maturity within the data protection and privacy profession where this field didn't exist 20 years ago. And I think if you look at the late aughts, early 2010s, it sort of started to hit its stride and really came to, I think, maturity during GDPR and sort of the pandemic period. But now with AI, with online safety, with content moderation, with emphasis on children's data protection, I do think we have to become almost digital generalists, digital compliance generalists, where these issues are not mutually exclusive anymore. I think you will still have privacy specialists. I think you will still have heads of privacy and chief privacy officers. You may see some siloing and cross-functional collaboration. But if you look at the evolution of roles that are being posted and people's career development across bigger businesses, I think you see the privacy professional leading on this, which I think is awesome. If you look at what the IAPP is doing, they are transforming from the trade group representing privacy professionals to really leaning into digital compliance. And I think those of us that are leaning into that, and I think we'll have a leg up on those that just want to stay in the privacy lane. And cyber is part of that as well. But I think you really have to understand all these issues around data and data security and digital compliance and not just focus on personal data. I've always felt like the data is the data. It really doesn't matter if it's personal data, if it's trade data, if it's, you know, commercially sensitive information. The controls that we've learned in the program elements that we've learned as privacy professionals are directly applicable to developing programs that are broader in scope.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. You moved from information security to privacy, and I feel like a lot of us who've been doing this for a long time, we were privacy and cybersecurity lawyers, and then people became more specialized. The reverse process where we're learning more and more in different fields as well. Okay, I ask all my guests this. How can privacy professionals help to foster innovation?
I think it goes back to the earlier questions to try to participate in the development process as early as possible and not be that person that's seen as the one that's going to say no to everything. I think you want to be trusted, you want to be valued, and you want to be available when the innovators within the organization have an idea that they come to you and say, is this a good idea? Would this be okay? In Denmark, they call it sparring. Maybe in the US, it's kind of like pick your brain, but you want to be able to have someone come to you to say, you know, is what I'm thinking crazy? Does it create too much risk? Is it going to create value for the organization if we start collecting all this on individuals? And maybe you could help them find a way to do it where it's not identifiable or it's only kept for a short period of time and then aggregated with other data sets. I don't know, but you want to be available and open to new ideas so that you can provide your feedback and seen as that trusted partner.
My last question for you, and I'll begin this by telling you that last night I was building the Lego horse castle with my five-year-old son. And then I told him that I was going to be interviewing somebody from the Lego group. And that was like the coolest thing ever. So what is the greatest Lego set of all time? And the correct answer is the Lego Trevi Fountain, but you can give me your answer.
I don't know.
What's your favorite?
So the one that I probably built in the last few years since I moved here. I'm a big superhero fan, so I'll give you two that I really love that I've built. One of them's retired, and that's the Batcave. It retired last year, so I'm a big Batman fan, and it's a shadow box that they designed that opens up, and it's based on, I think, Batman Returns, or, you know, sort of that original, like, Tim Burton type of Batman style. And it's very cool, because the shadow box, I don't know if you've seen it, has, like, the bat symbol in there. And then the other one I would say is the Daily Bugle. It's like the Spider-Man universe, and it's a skyscraper, and it's pretty tall, and that's still available, actually. But it's very cool. I've given that as different gifts to family in the past, and I think everybody that gets that is like, whoa, it's really cool. It's got a lot of minifigures. It combines like the original Spider-Man universe with like the Miles Morales Spider-Man universe, and it's pretty cool. There's cool Star Wars ones as well. I mean, it's hard to pick just one, but those two really, I think, I've nailed it in the last few years since I've been here.
Well, it certainly brings a lot of people joy. So thank you so much, Aaron, for joining the podcast. This was really interesting. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Kevin. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the 2-Byte Conversations podcast. You should look to us for more discussions on data and periodic updates on the state of the law. For more insights, headlines, and multimedia on data strategy, security, and privacy, visit hklaw.com/data strategy.